I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for October 9th. With Washington embroiled in an impeachment inquiry, has all hope for meaningful gun reform legislation been lost?
Nancy Pelosi is not interested in guns and gun protection and gun safety. All she's thinking about is this. She's been taken over by the radical left.
With action seemingly stalled at the federal level, we visit Kansas City, Kansas, where four people were killed and five injured in a shooting over the weekend, to explore local efforts to curb gun violence. Plus, expectations of forgiveness and empathy from Black Americans in the aftermath of violence.
It is important to realize that had this woman not been both white and an agent of the state, that her sentence likely would have been longer. There are Black and brown and poor people in prison and jail right now for far longer.
All right, here we go.
These mass shootings, you know, they're all alike and they're all different. Sometimes you get different lessons from each one of them.
Cannot comprehend the evil that struck El Paso.
Being killed by weapons that were made for battlefields, not neighborhoods in places like Dayton, Ohio.
We heard the first shot, then we heard a second one, and then after that it was rapid.
It was complete chaos.
We reiterated to the president the importance of action around these issues and guns, and that the people of Dayton are waiting for action from the Washington, D.C.
These orders, which would be granted upon clear and convincing evidence, would allow the removal of firearms from potentially dangerous individuals.
You know, the key to this, honestly, is making a law and not making a point.
I'm more than willing to have Donald Trump come visit if he's willing to do something. If not, he's not welcome.
I'm confident that if at this moment we do not wake up to this threat, then we, as a country, will die in our sleep.
In August, 31 people were killed in mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, putting gun reform at the center of the national conversation. By September, President Trump signaled a willingness to work with Democrats on the issue. Here he is on September 11th.
We're looking at background checks, and we're looking at putting everything together in a unified way so that we can have something that's meaningful. At the same time, all of us want to protect our great Second Amendment. It's very important to all of us. And I think progress is being made. I hope so.
But the president would soon be singing a different tune just days later, after Congress was alerted to his now infamous call with the president of Ukraine. The president said Democrats were focused on trivial pursuits, not the issues.
If Congress would ever get back to work, we could work something. But Congress is doing all of this nonsense, this garbage that they're doing. And I'll tell you what, they don't have any time. The Democrats in Congress are doing nothing.
2 days later, Nancy Pelosi announced an official impeachment inquiry, and according to reports from both Republican and Democratic members of Congress, talks with the president about gun reform have ended. Meanwhile, gun violence continues across the United States. On Sunday, a man killed four people and wounded five others at a bar in Kansas City. And we're going to bring you more on that story shortly. But first, Alex Yablon is a reporter at The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to gun-related news. And he joins me now to talk about the state of gun reform legislation in Congress. Alex, thanks for coming back on The Takeaway.
Glad to be back.
So where was gun reform legislation before the impeachment inquiry began?
It was as close to a real possibility as it has been at any time since Sandy Hook. You had folks like Mitch McConnell and others in the Senate signaling that they were willing to pass some kind of gun safety legislation, and they didn't really set out too many preconditions about what that might be. The only condition was, what can the president support? And the president had given signals to some, even Democratic senators, in closed-door negotiations that he was entertaining all kinds of policy proposals related to background checks and red flag laws. At the same time, and this is, I think, the really crucial context, the National Rifle Association looked to be in its weakest state in decades. It has itself been embroiled in an ongoing series of scandals about mismanagement and self-dealing and corruption at the highest levels of the organization, not to mention revelations that it's in very poor financial shape itself, which emerged after it was outspent by gun safety groups in the 2018 midterms, which was the first time that's ever happened.
So there was fertile ground, should we say, in the aftermath of these two most recent mass shootings. And really, there was some sort of political appetite for this. Now, here we are, post-impeachment inquiry. Obviously, that's taken over the news cycle. Are we hearing from Republicans at all on the issue? We just heard from the president who said, you know, Democrats are wasting time with this impeachment issue. But is there any appetite from the GOP to restart talks on gun control?
Mitch McConnell made very clear at the start of this that he was not going to advance any kind of legislation through the Senate that the president wouldn't support. And, you know, Mitch McConnell has pretty tight control over that chamber. With the president making pretty clear now that he's at open war with the Democrats in Congress, it seems like that possibility has been foreclosed.
We know, at least, again, we heard at the top in the montage there, we heard folks like Beto O'Rourke, who in the aftermath of the El Paso shooting and also in the most recent debate made some pretty strong statements about his ideas about gun control. Many of the Democratic presidential candidates have made gun reform an important aspect of their campaigns. How do you think it's going to play out in the election?
I think that it's definitely shifted from the last time that guns were a big issue in an election. You know, there's a real sense that suburban voters, moderates, are pretty fed up with mass shootings, and they have sort of lost sympathy for the NRA, which used to, even a few years ago, be one of the most consistently respected civil society organizations in the country. Now it's, I think, seen as a liability for a lot of Republicans, and it's seen by voters in suburban swing districts in which Republicans are very vulnerable as not really a great force in American politics.
Is there anything, I mean, the president, you know, I'm thinking about after the Parkland shootings, he sat down with students in a very public media-centric meeting right there to talk about that. He sort of indicated, as you mentioned earlier, some level of support for gun reform. Where does he stand now? I mean, is he able to be swayed at this point, given the impeachment inquiry that the Democrats have opened?
On the merits of the policy, I think he doesn't necessarily have a sort of hard and fast commitment to a sort of Second Amendment absolutism. Throughout his entire public life, he's talked pretty often about support for various gun safety legislation. The crucial thing is the politics. And in his political career, he has not really shown any appetite for any other strategy other than whipping up a hardcore base. Every time one of these mass shootings or rashes of mass shootings happens, he, I think, responds to the immediate horror by suggesting he could support some kind of gun safety legislation. But then he considers the politics. People like Mitch McConnell talk to him. Other prominent right-wing Republicans like Ted Cruz will come out and speak out against betraying their base on gun issues. And he always returns to that same position.
Now, we've got about a minute left here in the segment. Talks have halted in Congress. We heard about a week ago Nancy Pelosi indicate that she wanted to continue to work on this issue. Is that realistic, Alex, given everything that's happening, that Congress will actually take this up?
I mean, no. And this is not unique to guns. You know, I mean, the federal budget was sort of proceeding apace, and they had to adopt a sort of emergency continuing resolution for that to avert a shutdown. So on all kinds of issues, not limited to guns, the legislative agenda has been totally thrown up in the air by impeachment. Not that it was moving along so smoothly to begin with.
But there was something there.
There was at least a glimmer of possibility, and that's gone now.
Alex Yablon is a reporter at The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to gun-related news. Alex, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We move now to Kansas City, Kansas.
It is no consolation to know that this was not a random event. The tragic fact remains 4 persons were killed and 5 more wounded. Some children lost their parents. Some parents lost their children.
That was the Kansas City mayor there. Over the weekend, a deadly mass shooting unfolded at a bar in that city where 4 men were killed and 5 were injured. And it's part of a wave of recent gun violence in the Kansas City metro area. But it's also the kind of gun violence that has not been the focus of federal conversations around reform that we were just discussing. Mass shootings that involve high-powered assault weapons only account for a small portion of gun violence in the country, but they tend to dominate news coverage. In Kansas City, the gunmen opened fire with handguns. Joining us with the latest news from Kansas City, Kansas, is Chris Haxel, a reporter for KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri, and he's part of a national reporting collaborative called Guns in America. Chris, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what happened at the bar over the weekend?
So around 11 or 11:30 on Saturday night, a guy walked into a bar called Tequila Casey. Now, this is in Kansas City, Kansas, so that's on the Kansas side of the border. And he asked for a drink, and the bartender knew this guy. He knew he was sort of a troublemaker, so he refused to serve him, asked him to leave. The guy ends up getting in a fight with some other patrons. The police get called, but by the time police arrive, the guy's left. So then two and a half hours later, according to witnesses, the same guy comes back with a friend. They're both armed with handguns. They walk into the bar and they start shooting people. They ended up killing four people inside the bar, and then five people outside the bar were wounded. Both men fled the scene. One of them has been arrested. The original perpetrator who got into the argument in the first place, he's still at large.
Chris, do we know who the victims were?
The victims were four Latino men. Two of them were Mexican nationals. They range in age from their late 20s up into their 50s.
And do we know whether or not these victims were targeted, or was this just a random assault?
It's not entirely clear. Police have been, fairly tight-lipped. I mean, there have been some reports from witnesses at the scene who've been talking to the media who sort of indicated that the men did not, when they entered the bar, they did not seem to shoot indiscriminately, but rather were targeting certain people in the bar. But, at this point, it's not clear whether all of the people who were shot were intended targets or not.
How are the people in the neighborhood reacting and processing this shooting?
Oh, it's been a huge tragedy. I mean, this is a tight-knit Latino community. This bar sits on a small business corridor that features, several Mexican restaurants and other sorts of businesses. And what we've been hearing from people is that, I mean, this bar was more of a family-oriented hangout. It sounds weird to think of that with a place called Tequila KC, but I mean, it really is. It's a hole in the wall. It was a place, it had recently undergone new ownership, and it was a place where people would congregate and listen to music and dance and have fun.
Chris, KCUR reporters went and spoke to members of the community after the shooting, and I want to give our audience a sense of what they had to say.
I guess we're all kind of like family, I guess, because we all care for each other. Just like something like this is just really sad.
It could happen anywhere at any time. I even told my family, just because it was a bar doesn't mean nothing. It happens in movie theaters. I would really like for the violence to stop,
Anyone could have a gun right now. Anyone could come to your home and take your life. Those people suffering now because they miss their children. The children who are not at fault. How many tragedies have happened? And they always say the same, sorry, sorry. And they don't do anything.
Chris, is the community calling for specific reform after the shooting?
I mean, the community on both sides of the state line has, at least locally, has been calling for reform for years now. But local leaders are tied. There's very little they can do because both Kansas and Missouri have extremely lax gun laws.
Chris, in the Kansas and Missouri state houses, has there been any movement on gun control legislation?
Maybe a tiny bit of a nudge. I mean, Kansas has a new governor, Laura Kelly, who's a Democrat, and she has expressed some support for new gun control legislation. On the Missouri side, the governor is still a Republican. He has so far resisted calls to call a special session to discuss new gun control legislation, but he seems willing to maybe consider some options when legislators reconvene. But so far, I mean, it's not clear whether that's just sort of lip service or he actually intends to do anything.
And we're saying that this comes on the heel, this shooting at the bar in Kansas City, Kansas, comes on the heels of sort of an increase of gun violence in the community. What's driving that?
It's hard to say for sure. I mean, frankly, police are at a little bit of a loss. I mean, one of the problems that a lot of people point to is the free availability of guns. I mean, both states have almost no gun laws at all. Missouri in 2007 repealed a longstanding law that required you to get a permit from your local sheriff's office just to buy a handgun. Now, not only do you not need a permit to have a handgun, you don't need a permit to carry one concealed. A lot of the violence is group-based or gang-based, but police so far haven't been able to point to any like specific cause that's causing this increase.
So has any of this violence prompted larger talks around gun violence, if not by politicians, then by members of the public? Even outside of Kansas City, Kansas, and the surrounding communities calling for something to change?
I haven't heard a lot outside of the urban core. You got to remember both Missouri and Kansas outside of the urban centers, they're very conservative. And, you know, these are people who think of, you know, they're really concerned about their Second Amendment rights. They're into hunting, that sort of thing. The community in Kansas City itself is as interested in ever as doing what they can to combat violence. I mean, there are numerous nonprofit organizations that work to curb gun violence. It's possible that they're doing great work and that the problem would be even worse than it is if not for their help. But, I mean, it's hard to say for sure.
We just talked about efforts at the national level to talk about gun reform in Congress, which has since been stalled because of the impeachment inquiry. But regardless of that, Chris, I mean, as you know, much of the talk around gun control in Washington and even with Democratic presidential candidates is focused on high-powered assault weapons. How do people in the Kansas City metro area feel about that, given that this shooting did not involve a high-powered assault weapon?
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the statistics locally and nationally, the vast majority of these homicides are being committed with handguns, and the vast majority of suicides, which account for even more gun deaths than homicides, are also committed with handguns. And so, I mean, we have had some incidents that involved shotguns or AK-47s, but again, if you look at it statistically, you know, 90% or more of these crimes, I think, are being committed using handguns.
And Casey, you also did some reporting on what the Kansas City police are trying to do to combat gun violence. Tell us a little bit about some of the newer tactics that they're employing.
Right. So they're trying to deploy this technique that they learned about from the Tampa Police Department. They call it the Violent Impact Player Program. At least that's what it was originally called in Tampa. And the idea with that is to identify the absolute kind of most likely people, we're talking maybe 50 or 100 people, who are most likely to be quote-unquote trigger pullers. And so police are hoping to use kind of their street-level intelligence to create a list that they sort of, well, they're... It involves an algorithm, which, you know, they punch in all this stuff, which they won't tell us what goes into the algorithm, but it punches out a list of names who they then sort of target as people they want to go after because they think those people are the ones most likely to shoot someone.
And, you know, given all the conversation, I mean, generally when we see a shooting like this, a sort of indiscriminate shooting, there's often a big conversation that follows. A lot of political candidates have things to say, and then it tends to peter out, whether at the state level or at the federal level. Are people wondering, are they hopeful, from what you know, that Congress might take this up, or do they feel like this is an issue that's just best managed at the state level and forget about the feds?
I mean, I think anyone locally who's interested in creating more gun control is hopeful that something will happen at the federal level, but they're also hopeful that something will happen at the state level. I mean, Kansas had been under, you know, strong Republican control for several years, but now with a Democrat governor and a Republican governor in Missouri talking about maybe instituting some gun control, I think there is a little bit more hope than there has been in the past. Additionally, in Kansas City, Missouri, there's a new mayor who was elected, and one of the very first things he did was kind of help usher through a admittedly minor change, but it's a new city ordinance that prohibits possession of a gun by a minor. Again, it's not clear how much of an impact that could have, but, you know, people are hopeful it may help in some small way, I guess.
We'll pay attention and see what's happening. I've been speaking with Chris Haxel, who reports on guns and gun culture for KCUR, Kansas City Public Radio. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Last week, former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger was convicted and sentenced to 10 years for the murder of Botham Jean. Geiger entered Jean's apartment last year and shot and killed him, allegedly mistaking his apartment for her own. After the conviction, a striking scene unfolded in the courtroom when Jean's brother Brandt read his victim impact statement.
I'm not gonna say anything else. I think giving your life to Christ would be the best thing that both of them would want you to do. Again, I love you as a person. And I don't wish anything bad on you. I don't know if this is possible, but can I give her a hug, please? Please?
Yes.
Then later, the judge who oversaw the case, a black woman named Tammy Kemp, also hugged Geiger and handed her a Bible. These displays of empathy have sparked a robust debate about the expectations of black Americans in the aftermath of violence and injustice. Many have weighed in, including Bernice King, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter, saying that racism and white supremacy cannot be, quote, hugged out. We're joined now by three guests to talk about this and why it struck a chord with so many. Dr. Jen M. Jackson is an assistant professor of political science at Syracuse University who focuses on black politics, gender, and sexuality, and a columnist at Teen Vogue. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're also joined by Aaron Haynes, the Associated Press's national writer on race and ethnicity. Aaron, always great to have you on.
Good to be back with you.
And we also have Clint Smith. He's a PhD candidate at Harvard University and author of the forthcoming book, How the Word is Passed. Welcome back, Clint.
I appreciate it.
Aaron, let's start with you. One of the key witnesses in this case was killed last week. How is the community responding to that?
Well, we are still learning about that. Joshua Brown, who was the neighbor of Botham John, who testified during this trial, was killed over the weekend, and that case is still being investigated. Not sure if his killing was related to his testimony, but certainly that is a suspicion among many, particularly in the activist community. You know, they are seeing this as more than a coincidence, but authorities have not necessarily said that that is the case.
Clint, I want to talk about the outcome here in this case. Geiger was sentenced for 10 years, which some are saying was just too lenient of a sentence. And this has raised questions about how much time should someone do. Your thoughts on the idea that that sentence was too lenient?
No, I certainly understand the impulse of people, given the context of the case. What's important is to hold a couple of complicated truths together at once in this instance, and that allowing it to be complicated rather than cut and dry. So, for example, it is important to realize that had this woman not been both white and an agent of the state, that her sentence likely would have been longer. It is also important to note that there are black and brown and poor people in prison and jail right now for far longer, for doing far less harm. And it is important, I think, to recognize that 10 years is still a significant amount of time to be in prison. I think part of what has happened is that we have become so acculturated into believing that it is okay and that it should be expected that people are sentenced to life in prison, when actually we are very much an outlier historically and in the sort of contemporary world with regard to how long we sentence people to spend certain amounts of time in prison. Like, our sentences are particularly insidious and draconian, more so than anywhere else in the world. And so, as somebody who studies prisons, as somebody who works in prisons, I know that prisons are terrible, violent places, and we should be doing all we can to ensure that we are moving toward decarceration and making prisons increasingly irrelevant by creating the systems and structures and social services that put people's lives on fundamentally different trajectories. But it also is understandable, I think, for people to feel aggrieved and to feel that there is injustice. But I think part of what we should want is not for justice to be zero sum.
One of the things that stood out here in this case was that the jury itself was perhaps more diverse in terms of its racial demographics than other juries have tended to be. I want to play a clip from an interview with two of the jurors who took part in this case. This is from an interview broadcast on Good Morning America last Friday. And this might help us understand a little bit more about why, at least in this one juror's opinion, they sentenced Geiger to 10 years.
He was kind and just caring and forgiving. And I told everyone, I was like,
I'm really having a hard time with this because we all agree that it was a mistake, and I don't think Bo would want to take harsh vengeance. I think he would want to forgive her. I didn't feel like I had any right to speak for him, and he isn't there to talk for himself. But listening to how people talked about him, I felt like he would forgive her.
Jen, what do you make of what that juror just said?
So I think it's a really complex conversation, right? When we hear the jurors talking about Botham John, we have to understand this is an extremely religious family, right? We have to root this conversation in knowing that this is an orientation that roots this family's identity when it comes to empathy and forgiveness. However, I think when we think about what's also happening, I can't help but remember when there was this idea that somehow Michael Brown was not the best victim, right? That Michael Brown was no angel. And so when we think about a Botham John versus a Michael Brown, I think that's kind of what we see coming up here. And I want to draw attention to that because part of what I think is also happening is that we have this ongoing conversation about what it means for Black Americans across the spectrum, across identity markers of race, gender, sexual orientation, embodiment, being judged and deemed the right type or the wrong type of victims. And sometimes that affects the types of justice that is adjudicated because of those judgments and how those are made and how those come down. So I think what ends up happening in this instance, while we have people who are looking at these stories about forgiveness, we have to also think about the fact that there are biases, there are propensities that are triggering responses to the ways that people are making judgments about who Botham John was and who this family is and what they may have wanted and what he may have wanted. And those things are happening in kind of a tug of war. They're happening and putting pressures on the ways that this entire process is being judged because there's a history of anti-Black racism and a long-rooted systemic orientation toward anti-Blackness in our criminal judicial system. We know that the victim is often, even if they are not there, they are going to be judged, and the outcomes of those cases will often rest on how the victims are deemed in the court as well.
Aaron, I want to ask you about you've written about the responsibility that is placed on Black people to forgive, especially in the aftermath of violence and tragedy. Where does this idea originate in your reporting?
Well, you know, the folks that I spoke to, just to kind of piggyback on what Clint said a bit, I mean, there is a relationship between, I mean, certainly forgiveness as a Christian tenet is something that is present. But for Black folks, the relationship between race and faith and forgiveness are definitely tied together. And a lot of folks, in seeing the gesture by Brant John and then by the judge that was translated into this larger conversation about public forgiveness instead of the personal choices, they were reminded of the Charleston 9 shooting and the response of some of the families there to immediately say that they forgave Dylan Roof. And I actually talked in my reporting to the Reverend Sharon Risher, whose mother, Ethel Lee Lance, was one of the Charleston 9 who was slain in that attack. She was actually not among those who immediately forgave Dylan Roof. Her sister did say that she forgave him. And what she said is that, you know, it just always seems like Black people are given that heavy task of being able to forgive. It's almost like a generational DNA strand that we have as Black people, even going back to slavery. And really, kind of the unspoken message is that Black anger is unchristian, right? That we should be nonviolent and calm in the face of violence that is done to us and to our communities. And that's kind of a racial theater that we've seen play out over and over again throughout our history. You know, when somebody's personal choice to forgive is kind of taken on by the larger public and saying, you know, well, if he can forgive, you know, shouldn't we all be more forgiving? You know, what that does is really, you know, that centers Amber Geiger instead of Botham John, who was the victim here, and makes forgiveness really more about moving on than about the healing that gesture is intended to provide, again, not for the public, but for that individual who is doing the act of forgiving.
And to that point, Jen, I want to talk a little, because you mentioned the phrase tug of war earlier, and I'm thinking this burden of feeling that one has to express forgiveness, one has to express empathy, and yet the anger that that often Black communities and Black people, American Black people, are not allowed to exhibit, and this idea of having to comfort those who have done things that are in the name of oppression, that are in the name of racism. And so is that the tug of war that we're trying to unpack here, Jen?
When we were all talking just a moment ago, I wanted to think about respectability politics, right? I wanted to think about specifically the public performance of forgiveness as a mode of survival. So Roxane Gay has written about this. Jemele Hill's written about this. Some of us have also written about this. But the expectation that Black Americans should forgive in order to sometimes suppress additional emotive responses from certain communities, or to sometimes quell fears that there may be additional violence between groups, right? There's often this expectation that Black Americans who have been harmed should perform, and I say perform very deliberately, for forgiveness for parties who have harmed them, specifically because it does become a stand-in for absolution, right? And I'm not saying that it is one, but I'm saying that it's often read that way in ways that can be very detrimental.
And you mentioned performative justice and solidarity, Jen and Clint. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. We talked about, last time you were on the show, we talked about the 1619 Project at the New York Times and sort of the reframing of history and the history of slavery in this country. And one of the things that comes up in that conversation is how the United States, as a state, has not performed its performative justice, if you will, in any form to Black Americans, to the African American community in particular, for its role in slavery, whether that's through economic reparations or a formal apology. So at what point does this burden become even broader, where the state itself has refused in many ways to acknowledge both historically and economically the role that chattel slavery played in this country, and yet Black Americans still feel an onus on themselves to have to continue to do this performative justice?
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think that Jen made some really important points. And just to build on that quickly, I think, you know, what happens when forgiveness is not only used to mitigate the guilt, the sort of collective guilt and the interpersonal guilt that Geiger might feel or that the public might feel, but also when it is co-opted, and as it was, I feel like, with so many people, but particularly the Dallas Police Department, who put out a statement sort of using Botham Jean's brother's hug and expression of forgiveness as a means of attempting to move forward without reckoning with the sort of accountability that they have in what happened. And I think that Botham Jean's mother had a really powerful statement that didn't get as much attention as the hug.
That 10 years in prison is 10 years for her reflection and for her to change her life. But there is much more to be done by the city of Dallas. Yes. The corruption that we saw during this process must stop.
Amen.
And it must stop for you.
Amen.
Because after now, I leave Dallas, but you live in Dallas. And it must stop for everyone.
It's interesting to think about which sentiments are lifted up, and the way that the performance, as Jen talked about, of forgiveness was lifted up from Brant John, but from the sort of the very real concerns brought up by Botham Jean's mother did not get nearly the same amount of coverage, because they speak to something that is more of an indictment of the Dallas Police Department and of our sort of larger culture around policing. And as you mentioned, how all of this is entangled in a sort of larger history in which we are unable and have been unable for the last 400 years to grapple with how slavery has shaped every facet of American political, social, cultural, and economic life, and that the residue of such still shapes the sort of landscape of inequality that we see today and how different groups of people are treated at the hands of the state.
Clint is exactly right on that point. I mean, it really is exactly what he was saying, just the prioritizing of the forgiveness piece over Black anger or Black anguish. Black anger is not justified or acknowledged. You know, when you see that, you know, what a lot of the folks that I interviewed would say that it's a denial of Black folks' humanity to remove from Black people the agency of their anger, to say that, you know, it's unchristian for them to display that anger. It just doesn't allow them to be human. And you just don't always see similar calls for grace or compassion from white Americans who are victims of violence or who have lost a loved one. And so, that you know, we just don't ever really analyze white anger as being irrational or unjustified. And there's just never a policing of how white people are going to respond in a moment, as opposed to when these types of incidents happen in a Black community. Like, the question is always, you know, well, what are Black people going to do? Are they going to respond with violence, even though the violence was committed, you know, against that Black community?
Also, just to wrap up here, Jen, how do you think these expectations for Black Americans are changing, particularly when it comes to younger Black Americans today?
So my research, talking to young Black folks on the South Side of Chicago, and to Aaron's point, thinking specifically about what it means when young Black Americans are harmed and they recognize the harm and they feel anguish about that harm. What I've had young people tell me is that they feel that they are not allowed to actually express the fullness of human emotion, that they are not allowed, for instance, to go in public and express anger. And so what I'm finding is maybe not that the expectations of young Black Americans or Black communities are changing, but that for a lot of young Black Americans who I've talked to, they're just saying, you know, we are not going to allow these expectations to shape and dictate how we choose to move through the world and how we choose to address those in power for a redress of grievances. And while the expectations, I think, have remained relatively rigid, what's happening, at least in my research, is that young people have been organizing for a great deal of time. And what they've been saying is that, you know, enough is enough.
Dr. Jen M. Jackson is an assistant professor of political science at Syracuse University and a columnist at Teen Vogue. Aaron Haynes is a reporter on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. And Clint Smith is a writer, teacher, and doctoral candidate at Harvard University and author of the forthcoming book, How the Word is Passed. Thanks to you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.